It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Jason Snell is here, Andy Iannocco, Alex, Lindsay. There's lots to talk about. No one knows how many people are watching Severance. That kind of bugs Ben Stiller. It's still a success, I think. We'll also talk about the iPhone 14. It's on track for a September release. And the passing of the man who designed the Steve Jobs turtleneck. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 830, recorded Tuesday, August 9th, 2022. A latte and a baked good. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by 8 Sleep. Good sleep is the ultimate game changer, and the Pod Pro cover is the ultimate sleep machine. Go to 8sleep.com/MacBreak to check out the Pod Pro cover and save $150 at checkout. 8 Sleep currently ships within the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and select countries in the EU and Australia. And by Nuvei. Say goodbye to abandoned carts, poor approval rates, and high chargebacks with Nuvei. The platform fast-forwarding to the next generation of payments. Turn payments into powerful accelerators for your business at Nuvei.com. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. And as usual, we are just waiting for a big event in the next few weeks. Jason Snell is here, sixcolors.com. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
Good to see you.
Good to be here.
We were gassing before the show, and you produced a podcast, so you're very good. You're good.
It's a life of an independent worker. You're multitasking. That's my secret. Multitasking.
And another downstream hits the streams.
That's right.
That's wonderful. Right. Caught in the middle of an ocean, breaking down the business of binging. This is the show you were talking about that you did.
Yeah,
with
Julia Alexander, yeah. And I got to pick her brain for an hour about what the heck is going on with Warner Brothers Discovery.
I'm
going to
ask you about
David
that.
Zaslav.
I know it's not an Apple subject, except it kind of is. Apple's very much in the streaming business. That's Alex Lindsay of 090.media. They call it 090 and officehours.global.
A bunch of us are watching the Discovery thing, just eating popcorn. I'm like, what is going on?
Oh my god! Oh my god!
So much drama!
So much drama
over there. Yeah, exactly. So it'll be really
Alex,
interesting to see who's right.
We'll get your take on this too. But first, let's say hello to Andy Iannocco, WGBH in Boston.
Hello.
Who is the only one who has no dog in the streaming hunt? I guess. I don't know.
I can't have pets. It's probably I have enough trouble to take care of myself, frankly.
So. Once upon a time, there was HBO. HBO was owned, was started originally by whom?
Well, it's Warner, right?
Was it always Warner?
I think so. Mm. Warner Communications.
Okay.
I think so. I think it's always been part of that.
And then there was Discovery, which was a cable channel that's kind of morphed into a monster in streaming.
Yeah. Founded by sharks.
Founded by sharks.
It took a week.
Shark week. Then there was Warner Media and Warner Brothers Film. And then along comes AT&T and smushes them all into a giant meatball. And now the latest is that, weirdly, HBO, which turned into HBO Max, which meant it added a whole bunch of additional content to the kind of slim HBO, slim but prestige HBO library. And then now they're going to merge Discovery Plus. We talked about this on Sunday. Christina Warren had, as you might imagine, a lot to say about it. Discovery Plus, which is mostly reality TV, is now going to be merged with prestige TV into this ball, which we don't know what the name will be. Nick, what did Julia Alexander say about this? She follows this.
Yeah, you know, it's like Zaslav. The problem is last week, David Zaslav, who's the CEO, and he's sort of like responsible for this merger. He was the one who came to AT&T and they made this deal and they settled the company with a lot of debt. And
he's the guy who killed CNN Plus as well. First thing he did, very quickly.
He came in with his chainsaw and basically said, I got to get this company to be hitting our revenue targets.
He came from Discovery. He was at Discovery when it merged with Warner in the early part of the century.
Modern built the modern Discovery Channel that after, you know, Warner Media, again, you know, was fused with Time Magazine for a long time, fused with AOL, then bought by AT&T. And now we get to the AT&T put this basically in the hands of Discovery. And Zaslav, you know, a lot of the bad media last week was about, you know, they were canceling things and cutting things. And also they did a shareholder call and everybody sort of expects the shareholder call. Julia said it on that podcast that they expect it to be like a Disney product unveil or something. And no, it's an analyst call about financials. And so they were talking about financial stuff and not about the rest of it. So I think that their challenge is getting the message out that to the creative side of Hollywood, right? It's show business. The business side and the show side are different and they need to be kind of communicated with differently. So the show side of it, they need to communicate a little bit better because nobody likes hearing that, you know, a bunch of stuff's getting canceled and movies are being stopped just short of release and
Batgirl,
and put in the basement to never be seen and written off for tax purposes. So there's a bunch of challenges there, but I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about exactly. I mean, like they're
he's
not
a
on
quintessential
fire.
Suit. That's the thing. He's not a creative. He's a suit. He's a lawyer.
He's not. And he's fortunate because they actually have in Casey Bloys, who is the guy who runs HBO, they have one of, if not the best creative executive in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so I think they're going to be okay, especially on the TV side. I think that it's easy for people on the internet, especially, to run away and say, oh no, this means, are they going to bring back, you know, Succession? It's like, yeah, they are. Are they going to bring back Westworld? Probably they are. Right. It's not like that, but they are scrutinizing some stuff. Like the previous CEO was Jason Kilar, who we all remember from Hulu, and his job was basically to spend as much money as possible to get HBO Max launched, and he did it. And you know, that was not going to be tenable over the long haul, but he probably would have kept it going for a little while. And with him out and Zaslav in, Zaslav's goal is not to do that. He looks at HBO Max and says, okay, this is pretty good, but it's real expensive. And I've got all this Discovery stuff I can merge in to make something that's got kind of broad appeal, but also a little bit cheaper, like mixing your Guy Fieri with your Game of Thrones to get whatever you get with that. I don't know what that is.
There is
rashers of bacon with cheese on top.
I know. It does. They don't seem to go together, but we showed this on Sunday, the deck Zaslav showed at that call, showing the synergy between the two, which is basically they're complete opposites. But anyway, it's fascinating. There is a tie-in to this because HBO was run very successfully under the aegis of Richard Pepler, who left HBO when all of this happened and has produced a show for Apple TV Plus. It's doing very well, Blackbird.
He's got a first look deal with Apple, I believe.
Yes.
I believe
he was a refugee
to bring his stuff to Apple.
And it's interesting because Apple is now becoming the home of prestige productions, right? And Apple doesn't need to have, we've talked about this before, the giant catalog to keep people engaged. Apple is happy if they just, in fact, there's a great article about Ted Lasso with Hannah Waddington and the guy who plays Roy. And they thought they were making a great show that no one would watch.
Right, because who has Apple TV Plus?
Right.
Well, and there's that other story that I know we have it in our list too, which is about, there's a great interview with Ben Stiller, who's the executive producer of Severance on Apple TV Plus. An amazing show that everybody should watch. But it's not a new phenomenon, but it is also true of Apple, but it's true of all the streamers really, which is the interviewer says, so, you know, what information did you get from Apple about how well Succession did? And he says, honestly, until I went to Comic-Con and we filled a room of people who were excited, I wasn't sure that anybody actually saw it, because all Apple does is show you a little chart and with bumps. And
a typical Apple chart.
That's good. And that's it. Like, what does it even mean?
It's one of those Apple charts, and Stiller even says this, where you don't know, is there's a lot of growth.
No,
is it growth from zero or growth from 100 million? What is the, and that's going to be a problem, I think, because I think a lot of creatives want ratings. They're used to having ratings.
They're used to it. I don't know if they're going to get it. I mean, you know, the big thing is that, I mean, a lot of them are clamoring for it because partially they want to get paid for that. They want to get paid for the success of their events. So one of the reasons that no one wants to talk about numbers is they don't want to start having that conversation. There's a bunch of reasons not to share the numbers. Number one is that knowing what's working and not working is part of the secret sauce to a lot of these these streamers. And so knowing that this one is doing exceptionally well and this one isn't doing as well, and all the math related to that is something that is how they generate what they're going to do next. And they don't want to necessarily give that away. So they generally only do it when they want to show the reason that you talk about how many people are watching it is mostly so that you can attract more creators. like, hey, this went really well, and look at how many millions of people watched it. And imagine if that had gone out to the theaters, and all those other things to try to get more talent. But they don't usually want to give up the data. They don't want to give up the data so they don't have to negotiate about it. They also don't want to give up the data to show others, what's working. And finally, they don't want to give up the data because they don't want to be compared to each other. So, Apple has a lot less people than Netflix. And so they don't want to, if Apple says, well, we got 8 million people watching it or whatever, and Netflix goes, well, that's like our smallest show, then that makes Apple look small. So there's a lot of reasons that they don't want to share those raw numbers, but it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with HBO. I mean, I think that he's right in a lot of ways. I think that, everybody has to figure out how to, we're going to see some more discipline.
You think it's because consumers don't want to subscribe to many, many services. They just want one.
Not one, but I think that Peacock and Paramount are really struggling because they came in too late. And a lot of people have kind of decided, well, I got a lot of content right now. So, a lot of people seem to be having HBO Max, Disney Plus, Netflix, Apple, and maybe one more, and then once you get to those, they have so much content. Oh, Amazon Prime comes with a lot of people's Prime things. So that's the fifth one. You have so much content in front of you to choose from that I think that everybody else is now having a hard time figuring. I think you're going to end up a shakeup where you see more acquisitions, buying up Paramount or other things, because I just don't think they can make the turn, they don't, that's the problem.
The market thinks Netflix is over.
I think that's less.
Well, there's still. I mean,
that's a hyperbole. No. I think, but
that's like saying that's like saying that Windows is over. It's still, it has
Facebook's
82%
over. I mean, no one's going to use Facebook. Kind of thing.
When you see the analyst chart about the, it's only speculation, but this is an analyst speculation on what the numbers are. the chart goes like this: there's Netflix, and then there's everybody. There's Netflix. There's Disney Plus. And the Disney Plus part of the graph has just jumped up in recent years because, of course, it's just Disney. But underneath Disney, there's just a big clump of people, including Apple, including everybody else. So, no, Netflix isn't going anywhere.
Netflix stock is down 62% since the beginning of the year.
The growth has tailed off.
Yeah.
And they were priced as a tech stock, and everybody's realizing they're an entertainment company and should be priced accordingly. Yeah.
And I think that one of the challenges Netflix will have is that because – one thing that we don't talk about a lot with a lot of these is the cost of distributing all of these. And one of the things that Netflix does is they compress their footage more than everybody else. And they've done it in a couple different ways. And like, for instance, I found that Gray Man in portions in portions it was unwatchable because of the dialogue, and in other portions it was unwatchable because of the compression. And I think that that's going to be a real challenge, is because Apple and Disney Plus they are clearly providing better quality content. What I mean by that is better quality compression. And I only bring that up because you feel like you're in a better place when you watch stuff that doesn't have, most people don't consciously notice the little blocks that are appearing in the dark areas. But it feels cheaper when there's a lot of that there. And I think that we have to pay attention to how consumers feel. Like, are they going into a nice place, or are they going into kind of McDonald's? And I think that the problem that Netflix has right now is that a lot of the content feels like you're going to McDonald's, because no matter how much money they spend on producing it, it looks bad
right now,
when you watch it.
Or maybe this has changed, but for a long time, Netflix, you wanted to watch Netflix on Apple TV because Apple was doing the back end for Apple TV versions of Netflix. So it looked better on an Apple TV. Think that's changed, or is that...
I don't think that that's the case, but I mean, it definitely anymore. Looks significantly better. Maybe before Apple had its own service.
Yeah, now they don't want to, right? Yeah, they would just as soon not compete with Netflix.
Let them do what they're going to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I always wonder how much that how big an effect that kind of stuff has on the bottom line. Because look, if I want to see Better Call Saul, I wouldn't even particularly care if it's only being shown in HD compared with absolute 4K, 120 frame per second HDR presentation of a show that I couldn't give less of a damn about. And
it's just a matter of
it has to be good enough, I think.
I think that it has to be good enough. The problem really gets into is when I decide, oh, I'm going to look at something else. And it's just people, how people feel about that brand.
I know
brand
what you're saying. It's like if you're in a neighborhood kinda, with manicured lawns and you know, beautiful streets and trees versus a rundown neighborhood, you feel better in a nice neighborhood, right? Even if the content is
just because a lot of cars have four wheels, but you know, there's a lot of different feel that you have when you're in different ones. And so I think I think that it can be, you know, because you kind of, you know, Netflix again kind of feels like the cheaper version of a lot of this stuff. And so when you go into it, like if you have to make some hard decisions about what you're going to keep as a subscription service, you know, Netflix, like for me, Netflix is on the outer edge. Like if I decided I needed to cut back, Netflix would be the first thing I got rid of.
We watched, this was a perfect example. We watched a show that is being made by Showtime, but we watched it on Amazon Prime, the first episode in the season, because Amazon Prime had a Showtime deal, or maybe they were offering it for free. And then I realized, oh, we should be watching this on Showtime where it was 4K, and it's a different show. Even though it's not my favorite show in the world, it's a different show.
And again, it reduces the stickiness of the show. It also... Yeah. Again, it affects creators. Like I can't believe the Russo brothers would be happy with what ended up showing up on. They should be unhappy about some of the dialogue and some of the VFX in Gray Man. But I can't believe that they'd be happy with the level of visual quality that they ended up with Netflix. I mean, they spent all that time and money on something that there's no other place to see it, and the place that you can see it looks...
It's interesting because Game of Thrones was streamed by HBO and HD. They're now redoing it in 4K. And I started watching it. It's a big difference. It's a huge difference.
So they have it now in 4K because they had a real compression problem too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Remember with that last episode 8 in the last season,
it was just blocky, block.
So I haven't gotten the last season. I just watched the first episode, but it is remarkably better. Mm-hmm. That people who had the Blu-ray DVD are seeing it in 4K, but HBO never streamed it that way. They're only doing that because they have a prequel that they're going to let go in next month.
I think that they'll stop it. They should just stop at season 5 so that we don't remember
how bad the rest was. Yeah.
You know, so, I'm still dealing with the scars of that.
That is I hadn't even really thought about that, but that's a significant increase in their cost to do.
Oh yeah.
Go to 4K.
That's the whole thing. And the hard part is that you're not paying per show. When you pay, you know, $15 to download it, I can give you a much higher quality because it's a cost per unit, right? Yeah. But if I have to, if the show is a gigabyte more, now that may not seem like a lot. Like if it's a gigabyte more to deliver it to you at a higher quality, that may not be a lot, but it's still, let's say, 3 cents a gig that is now multiplied by a million.
Well, remember, I don't know if people remember, million, but HBO, you know, that's the actually had streaming problems when on the last episode of the very last episode, I remember that people couldn't watch it because their streams are down. You had to watch it on the cable.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope Apple TV though does not suffer, and I wonder if it might from this Ben Stiller problem or the Hannah Waddington problem, where we don't really know if anybody's watching this until we go to a Comic-Con. That's not really a good it could make Apple TV Plus kind of a refuge. Notice the new movie that they're promoting quite heavily. That's how they responded to this. Well, we're going to promote you like crazy. Luck, which took over the front page on Apple TV, is actually a John Lasseter movie. He was forced out of Pixar for, they claimed, inappropriate behavior. I'm a friend of John's. I know John, and I will just say he's a cuddly kind of guy. But so I don't know if that was a completely, I don't know what happened there. But reviews aren't great for Luck right now. But they're trying to do, Skydance is kind of trying to do what Pixar did.
I think the hard part is that you got John Lasseter, who is, you know, an amazing talent when it
brilliant
comes to storytelling.
Yes.
But the infrastructure of Pixar and how they manage every single scene is so, like, it is a cutthroat. Every scene, every word is attacked. Every sentence is attacked. Every scene is attacked. And so I don't know if Skydance has, and he's the one that designed that. So he, you know, but I don't know if they have that yet where they're, and it just makes a huge difference in storytelling.
If there is a story that the script was finished before Lasseter joined Skydance, he worked on it, but, really the next,
I heard that he ripped it all up.
Yeah. Yeah. But the next one will be the one where we see if he starts from scratch, whether he can get that XR magic. Anyway, yeah, I would hope that Apple TV doesn't become a refuge. Apple's doing its best not to.
I think it would only be that way if someone, if other companies start giving everybody the numbers, then that becomes.
So you don't get it. You get numbers from HBO though.
Nobody's giving streaming numbers out.
Not even HBO.
Nobody wants to do that.
Netflix does their ratings charts,
yeah,
but they're not real numbers. They're like hours viewed. Nobody's really giving it away because they do believe that it's trade secrets and it's the crown jewel. So you end up, the problem is not the ego. I mean, ego boosts are part of it, right? Knowing people love your thing is going to make you as an artist probably more excited about doing the next thing instead of just shouting into the void. But also you got to negotiate your next gig. And if you can say, look at this huge hit, that's one thing. And if you can say, they tell me that the charts were good, that's not necessarily going to be clear about what you should be paid for your next gig. I do think that an Apple is definitely one, but it's not alone. Things like awards end up being a proxy in some cases. So like Ted Lasso, they may not know what their numbers are, but they know the awards they've gotten. And Severance is a great example of that. There's the Comic-Con audience, sure. But I would argue that the real good thing for the makers of Severance is they got all those Emmy nominations. And so it's like somebody, they are getting their ego stroked at least a little bit, that people appreciate the work that they're doing. But we do listen, I would love for there to be some sort of detente where everybody gets some number that they release that they agree on, because that's my problem with it. My biggest problem with it is it actually suppresses people's earning potential if nobody knows how well that show did.
Yeah, absolutely. That's typical for Hollywood. They're generous with awards, generous with prestige, generous with praise. If it comes down to data that would help you come back at a contract negotiation with them and saying, hey, look, we know that we're generating 18% of the revenue for your entire channel. We want to be paid commensurate with the value that we're delivering. They don't want to give you that.
The friends problem.
Yeah.
In fact, and I think that's why you see a lot of shows that do very well get canceled in their third season, because it's going to cost a lot more, for talent.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Jason knows Babylon 5, the creator of Babylon 5 was brilliant because he had an experience in the TV industry to know that if he wants this thing to end after five seasons, if he had a five season story to tell, he designed all the contracts so that the show would implode after season five.
Yeah.
That if it were so successful that they wanted to renew it after season six, everybody would have to negotiate all at once, and then there would be that would cost too much money. Friends is a great example. The reason why they all got so much money was because they decided to essentially form a Friends leading cast union and say, you negotiated with us as a group. You can't single out one of us for stardom and basically put us, the rest of us, at 1/10 wages. This is why labor. The more a workforce, no matter at what level, gets to organize, understand how much they get paid, and understand their contribution materially to the company, the better off those workers are going to be.
So this is why I hate suits. I mean, I have some experience with this. TV executives want to make stars. They don't want to pay stars. So there's this tension between, stars drive ratings drive revenue, then stars ask for more money, now we got a problem. And there's this constant tension. And suits have no, this is all for them, this is all financial calculation. This is not about, content creation or anything like it. It's about how can we make more money.
And that's the great advantage that Apple and Amazon have doing their, ecosystem play, where the money doesn't kind of matter because it's part of a larger picture thing, is it allows Amazon and Apple to say, we love you and we'll pay you money. Whereas at HBO Max, they all know that Casey Bloys has David Zaslav right behind him saying, your budget is what for that?
Yep.
And that is an advantage that you have if you're not playing the same game as everybody else. Yep. And Amazon and Apple are there.
Apple, we know, is looking to acquire properties like the NFL Sunday Ticket. They're in the running for that $2.5 billion deal next year. Now news, Apple's in talks to acquire streaming rights for Big Ten college athletics. That's interesting, huh?
One of many, right? That that headline is a little bit misleading because they're in the talks along with Amazon and ESPN and there are others too. It sounds like, not to get too far in the weeds for people that don't care about sports, but basically Fox and ESPN are the big players in terms of televised college sports in the U.S. And ESPN has a deal with the SEC now, which is the number one college conference for football. And so Fox has the number two deal, which is with the Big Ten. And so this is basically the scraps. Fox is literally leading the negotiations with their competitors here to sell sub packages out of their package.
Oh,
so
interesting.
It'll be scraps. But one of the things that all the college football consortia are talking about is there sweet, sweet streaming money to be had? And if you're not in the package with ESPN, which the Big Ten seems to not be, if that doesn't come to pass, where do you put that stuff? Because ESPN has ESPN Plus. They've got infinite inventory for your college football. If you're not there, though, where do you go? And the answer might be Apple or Amazon or Peacock or Paramount Plus or some other streamer for not the marquee games, but, you know, college conferences, you're talking about a lot of football games every weekend. There's plenty to go around.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just Big Ten. This is not, you know, I mean, there's the SEC, which is probably arguably more popular. Mm-hmm. I love it, though, that Apple's playing ball, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's and we'll continue to see this. I mean, the reality is that within the next decade, the broadcasters are not viable, like, to be able to keep on competing with these streamers. You know, the streamers are just dipping their toes in and playing with it. These are not big budgets for them. And for broadcast, they are becoming bigger and bigger budgets because their cut of making money is getting smaller and smaller. So broadcast is shrinking. These streamers are getting bigger and the streamers have, you know, much more money than they do. So it's really a matter of the streamers proving that their market's big enough that they're not going to get blowback for taking over the big stuff. And that's probably still 3 to 5 years away. But you'll probably see, you know, a lot of it'll be nice for a little while, but within the next 10 years, if we have any on broadcast, I'd be pretty surprised.
Yeah,
actually, I would disagree only in the sense that Disney is a major player in sports in America because they own ESPN and they have the advantage of having broadcast and cable and streaming. Mm-hmm. And so they can dole it out and they can sort of section it off. And that gives them some luxury that a player like Fox, it's a harder sell, right? But Disney has got all the bases covered. And I think that allows them to put a tiered kind of package together where it's on streaming, yes, but it's also on ABC or it's on ESPN. Right.
And let's not forget, ESPN has El Ocho and the big Excel championship. If you are a spreadsheet, mm-hmm. I missed this. I'm so sad that I did not see this. Excel Esports. I guess last weekend ESPN did the El Ocho, the Ocho, which was the joke in the Dodgeball, the movie Dodgeball, and among other things, they had Excel spreadsheet Esports All Star Battle. I want to play this so bad, but I know they'll just take us down if I do. A tournament in which an unexpected full-column flash fill is announced like a 50-yard Hail Mary, according to Kevin Purdy, writing in Ars Technica. The Financial Modeling World Cup, which is actually real. In fact, I remember we reported on it when it was going on. I guess this is an edited version of the championship, which was a few months ago, but still...
It's actually engaging. And it's not like, okay, you know, create a chart that does this. Here is like a gigabyte of raw information. They'll give you the preface of there is a company that is trying to build a brand new factory in three new competing markets. They don't know what they should do regarding put their money in A, B, and C. Here is, again, an enormous pile of data. We need you to generate information and reports for A, B, C, and D. And then you see people like, I understand the trick where you can highlight a list of numbers and then click a cell to put the sum in there. But the way that they've got that automation going, you know that there are extreme athletes in every possible operation that people who know that and it's completely locked. It is funny, but I like the idea of there should be more than five sports on TV, whether it's streaming or broadcast. I like the idea that at some point you're going to see high diving in Acapulco. I like the idea that at some point you're going to see organized speed climbing competitions, side by side speed climbing competitions, stuff where I don't know what the rules are. I don't know who, I have no dog in this hunt. I'm just blown away that humans are doing something at the apex of what humans can possibly do. And I hope that all these streaming channels give opportunities for individualized sports programs to find homes.
That has happened. And I think I agree with you. I think that's already happening and will continue to happen. The Olympic sports, especially anything that's got the imprint of the Olympic sports, those things tend now to be available on streaming year round. And I don't know if you've got ESPN Plus, Andy, but boy, oh, there's some stuff on ESPN Plus that you're like, that's a thing? And it's like, yes, that is a thing, whether it's like Irish hurling or, I mean, like, there are so many.
Irish hurling has nothing to do, by my eye, with a hot dog eating championship. That's a completely.
No, that's a different kind of hurling. Irish hurling is sort of like soccer and field hockey, except you hit each other with sticks. It's amazing. And that, or something like curling, which is an Olympic sport, which is, those are always on, or lacrosse. And like, yeah, there's a lot of smaller niche sports that are finding their way on streaming because, right, like, other than the cost to produce it, you can make it available and there will be hopefully a fervent audience that loves it that will find it.
Yeah.
Excel may be going a little too far.
Well, be careful too, because if you trip on a pivot table, you might hurt yourself.
Ooh, ow. So the second round, the semifinals, simulating a yacht regatta in Excel. Ooh. And then the finals, an entirely Excel-based retro-style 2D platform. And they had to create a score tracking mechanic. Wow. Now, if you feel like maybe you have some skills in Excel, October, the big FMWC Open 2022, Excel Esports for All. It's open. That means anybody can compete. So just, you know, you might want to. It's the FM Financial Modeling World Cup, fmworldcup.com, and it will be live streamed. Probably there's not by ESPN.
there should be a pro am in front of it, just like the U.S. Open for golf.
This is a pro am. This is an am. In other words, because it's open, anybody can compete at pros and amateurs. But with a $10,000 prize fund, I imagine there'll be some pros in there as well. I don't know. What will I be solving? The game tasks. We'll be testing your Excel and logical thinking skills. There's a card game. There's a share the ride. There's It's a Snake. I think this is hysterical. And you can, I think you can do it from your home. I don't think you have to go anywhere to participate. Final round. We'll be covering the grand finale November 12th. One session, 8 players, live streamed.
No time limits, no substitutions. It's battle to the death, just like Rollerball.
4 enter the octagon, only 1 emerges. Let's take a little break. We actually have some Apple news. I swear to God.
We said the word Apple a lot.
Many times. Yeah,
there's 20 been a minutes. Lot of Apple.
Yeah, we did a whole segment where we were just trying to jam the word Apple into things that weren't
Apple. Apple.
I think we did
see,
okay.
You happy now?
I think we did fine.
Yeah, you
I
can use
if
you, Excel.
If you look
Mac.
At Word Cloud, you'll see Apple as one of the large
there
words.
There you go. Our show, you know what? One of the big words in my life, and it's a puffy little cloud, is sleep. Getting a good night's sleep is the ultimate game changer. It nature's gentle nurse. In fact, consistently good sleep can reduce the likelihood of serious health issues, decrease the risk of heart disease, lower blood pressure, even reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. I notice having a good night's sleep reduces my appetite, so I don't have to overeat. And yet still more than 30% of Americans struggle with sleep. One of the number one reasons right now, especially, feeling hot at night, sweaty, tossing and turning, looking for some refreshment. That is a problem. That's why I love our 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover. We got it almost a year ago, so we went through winter with it, which is nice because the Pod Pro cover can warm up to as hot as 110 degrees, so it can really be nice and warm. But it also can go as cool as 55 degrees, so it can cool you off as well. And what's great with the 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover is it does it dynamically. It monitors the room temperature, it monitors your temperature, your restlessness, and maintains the optimal sleeping temperature for what your body needs. It turns out that when it cools down, you go into a deeper sleep. That cleansing deep sleep is so important. dynamic cooling and heating with biometric tracking. That's the secret of the 8 Sleep Pod Pro cover. And by the way, it's got two sides, because Lisa, my wife, has a very different need for warmth and coolness, so it does it separately. Her side gets quite hot, in fact, but mine does not. I like to go to bed where it's kind of warm, cool off at night. Even in the wintertime, I did this, and then warm up to wake me up. It's got a little vibration, too, so you can have a very subtle alarm if you want to get you up in the morning. I find I don't even need the vibration. I just need the subtle warming is enough to say, oh, yeah, morning, time to get up. With more deep sleep, you can be confident your mind and body are getting those restorative sleep stages vital for physical recovery, hormone regulation, mental clarity. Now, this is the new one, by the way. They just launched the next generation of the Pod 3, which enables more accurate sleep and health tracking, double the amount of sensors, so you get the best sleep experience on Earth. The Pod Pro cover from 8 Sleep. It's not magic, but it feels like it, and I love it. Go to 8sleep.com/MacBreak. Start sleeping cool this summer. You'll save $150 on checkout on the Pod Pro cover. And 8 Sleep Good News ships within the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and now select countries in the EU and Australia. So our overseas listeners, our international listeners, you can get it to 8sleep.com/MacBreak. EIGHTSLEEP.com/MacBreak. Lisa and I love it. I have to say the cats love it too. They really like it when it's warm. Our cat Paris is under the covers right now on our 8 Sleep, nice and toasty warm. I made the bed and I heard this meowing and I went, what's that kind of muffled meowing? Then there's a lump. I said, oh, that's Paris under there. Very happy with the 8 Sleep cover. Cat approved. All right, Apple News. I promised you Apple News. There's actually, the headline story was going to be iOS 16 now adds a percentage for your battery. Woohoo! But, you know, we can't have nice things because already again, people are saying, oh, maybe you don't want this. What? Again,
a choice.
Did we used to have this?
Yeah, we used to. Yeah, you used to have that, and then they took it away, and now you can put it back if you want.
And now you can have something that the precision is greater than the accuracy.
Saying I like that line. The precision exceeds the accuracy.
That happens all the time. People tell you that is 0.1 da, da 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 da, and that's like okay. Well, that it's not accurate enough to be that precise. And so
yeah, Alex. It's the Friday Night Baseball where they say his chance. The first few weeks it was on the chance of getting on base was like 52.33%, and it's like that's way too much precision. You don't actually know the percentage that way.
Exactly.
And this is like that too. I talked to a battery engineer once who works at Apple. This was a few years ago. And, you know, the fact is they're measuring the power that's coming out of the battery and making an estimate. Like, it's not a real percentage. Like,
it's like
none
it's
of these batteries
then
are.
Then it's 82. Yeah, and then it's like, you know, it depends on what you're doing with
none
it.
None of them.
You know? Yeah.
Exactly. And in fact, they lie to you. I don't know if people know this. Since the battery health thing, Apple has tried to be a little more above board about what it's doing here. But like, there are times when Apple will tell you that it's full, but it won't recharge it. All the way to full, it'll stop because it's trying to extend your battery health. And now they try to do it where they then charge it when they think you're going to be leaving in the morning so that it's up at 100%. But they, you know, for a long time there, you'd lay it down, you'd be checking in the evening and say it was at 100%. And you're like, good. It's charging at 100%. And it would stop charging and still say it was charging at 100% because it's trying to outwit you because what you want to do with your phone's battery is bad for your phone's battery. So
you're out of gas, and I've proven that you can drive it still quite some ways after it says.
I have to say though, I hate it when I wake up in the middle of the night and I see an alert that says my phone's only charged 50%. It'll be fully charged by 7 a.m. Really bugs the hell out of me. Just fill it up, will you, please? I don't. What's this dribbling it out over a period of time? What if I got up and I had to go somewhere? Come on, Apple. So there
are at the very
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Or at the very least, give me a look. I know this is going to damage my battery, but having 100% in the next 8 minutes before I board this plane is way more important to me than losing 2 hours of battery life 3 years from now.
Don't be a battery nanny. Come on, man.
And that's why I think they changed it. That's why now you get this information of like, we aren't going to charge your battery right now, but we know you usually leave and don't charge at 9 a.m. And so then we'll charge it to full. A lot of electric cars do this now, too. And it's the same idea, is that they want to be efficient, but they also need to tell you what they're doing and give you an opportunity to override it. And but the larger point stands, which is there's a lot of things that we think of as exact science when it comes to our batteries that are not really true. And so, yes, thank goodness I can say that it's 83% now. But is that helpful? I mean, I get how it might be reassuring, but I'm not sure it's helpful.
Well, I hope you paid attention in high school. I know my physics and my math teachers were constantly talking about precision and how, you know, you had to know what the
significant digits
were. Very good. Of course, we were using slide rules, so it really did matter back then, because it was really pretty much a guess.
How thick is that line? Like the thickness. I remember talking, having a thing in chemistry, Russ, we had a long conversation about the accuracy of the thickness of the line.
The cursor,
That we were, not on a computer, but like...
No, it's called a cursor on a slide rule. Yeah. That's what it's called.
And so you were like looking at it, like going, but can we actually be more accurate than that? Because the line
is... And really good slide rules, they would use like hairs for the line.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So already in 9 to 5 Mac, Jose Adorno is writing, comment, the problem with the iOS 16 battery percentage icon. And it's not what you think it is. It's that down to 20%, it looks like you got a full battery. It was only after 20%. See, here's a 78% battery, but it's fully filled in. They only partially fill it in once it's below. Yeah,
the
20.
Icon is no longer meaningful. It's only the number inside the number. Icon that's meaningful.
Now, I presume I could switch this off, right? I don't have to have a percentage.
I think so.
And you should, because it's silly.
But everybody wants
it. You want to be silly.
I don't know. I have an iPhone mini, and this feature is not available for the iPhone mini.
Oh, yeah. It's only a limited...
too bad.
First of all, not all iPhones with a notch will have the new battery percentage icon. The 13, 13 Pro, 13 Pro Max will, 12, 12 Pro, 12 Pro Max will, 11 Pro, 11 Pro Max, the iPhone XS and XS Max, and the iPhone X. That's it. So, yeah, no minis. Mm-mm. You have a mini, Jason?
I do. iPhone 13 mini. I love it.
You prefer it?
Yes. Huh. Tiny phones.
You're probably going to be out of luck, right, in the next month?
Totally. I'm hosed. Yeah. Absolutely. I bought this last year, and I usually hold on to a phone of my own for a couple of years, so I've got another year with it. But yeah, it's not coming back. I'm an outlier on that one.
Yeah. Did Apple not sell a lot of them? Is that why they're not making them anymore, or...
Yeah. In fact, I think they didn't sell a lot of the iPhone 12 mini, because we heard even before the 13 mini came out that they wasn't going to be a 14 mini.
Yeah.
And I think for good reasons, they want to experiment. And the idea of doing a Max phone that's not a Pro Max is interesting to them. And I think will probably sell incredibly well, and they'll be happy that they did it.
I think it also turns out that we now have cameras that happen to do other functions. And so, I mean, the cameras on all the camera options that are on these Pro, on the bigger phones. I mean, it's just amazing. I just look at it like a phone. It's a camera that happens to do other phone functions to me at this point. You know, I don't,
I think that mostly it's because the people who are interested in smaller phones aren't interested in premium phones. It's not that they're buying based on price, but the fact that they want a smaller screen, something that's easier to stick in a pocket, that they can operate without being quite so showy about it, are not necessarily the people who want something that folds three ways, has 18 lenses, and has satellite communications. They're happy with a $400, $500 phone. And one of those things that they find in those $400 or $500 phones is that they can be compacter, because they don't have to put quite so many expensive full-featured parts in it. Now, those socketed chips, those do take up a lot of space in those cheaper phones. But other than that.
One thing I was reading, and I don't know how accurate this is, but the rumor is Apple will not release iPad OS 16 at the same time as they release iOS 16. iOS 16 will probably come out with the new iPhones, but iPad OS will be delayed an extra month. The rumor is that it's problems with Stage Manager, that it's not what they want it
it's
to
more,
be.
Well, I think it's more like complexity with Stage Manager. This is an app. This is a total rethink of how you interact with apps on the iPad and on the Mac. And so there's such a compelling motivation to get it right that, and Apple is never the company that says we're going to put every feature out there and make it complex and we'll debug as we go. They really are. We are okay with doing something that does half of what we think it should ultimately do, so long as it works right out of the gate. And if you're not going to make a good first impression, that's how people wind up never using this feature you spent so much time and money on. I mean, I don't tend to use full screen apps. I don't tend to use workspaces a lot on the Mac, and there are a lot of other examples of features on the Mac that I don't really use, not because they aren't good, but because they just never presented themselves in such a compelling way that I can't imagine working without them.
Yeah. It's I was going to say that too. It's a well said. It's the iPad has been drifting to the Mac, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's more Mac-like all the time. Stage Manager makes it even more Mac-like. The Mac comes out, Mac OS comes out a month later anyway. There are going to be the rumor is new iPad Pro that's going to come out in October. So you time this announcement and new Macs in October, new Mac OS in October.
Yeah.
Why not take the extra time? And then let's not forget the biggest picture of all, which is half of Apple's revenue is the iPhone. The iPhone is what matters the most. If you're making OS decisions in late summer about what to do in order to ship your OS for the fall, the iPhone will win every single time. And so if you're an iPad user or developer, you're like, you know, if you could get the iPad to, like, just get out of the way a little bit, let them ship that first OS revision for the iPhone, and then, you know, get a little extra time to wrap up the iPad work, I think that's all for the best, because it is becoming more and more like a Mac all the time. And so having it wait till October, like, it makes sense, because the iPhone event is in September, not an iPad event.
And as someone who will most likely upgrade around February, I think it's fine. so I think it's like the iOS tends to be a little better, but I tend to wait. I think that a lot of things get cleaned up between about, you know, when it's released and about the end of February, and then I think that a lot of focus, you know, turns to WWDC and everything else, and so I think that most of what you're going to get as far as fixes happen then, that's a really great time to update.
I
have upgraded the last version because I was really excited about some keynote stuff. I updated my Mac OS much earlier because of the new keynote live stuff. And I don't think I'll do that again. I think that was a really painful fall. So I think I'll wait until March 1.
I haven't noticed that Stage Manager is particularly buggy or anything. I've been using the iPad OS beta, public beta on my iPad Pro. It seems to work fine. I mean, I don't use it that much.
I think when you use a lot of the Apple stuff, I think what you really see is when you start going off into the developer stuff that is asking for things that, you know, Apple may not approach that way.
Yeah.
And things get a little funky.
That'd be invisible to an end user, really.
Yeah.
They're still tweaking some of the details of Stage Manager, and I think they're doing a good job of it. Like, I think it feels more cohesive than it did even a month ago. Mm. There are bugs, though, and my friend Federico Vitici at Mac Stories, he says it's getting really buggy. I think it's an effect of them making changes, is that they're letting the bugs kind of hang out there while they make it more usable, and I'm okay with that. But, you know, his example that I think is a really great one is sometimes you click on a link and you've got two windows open, a link in a document and Safari, and you click on the link in the document, and what you expect is that, what would it do? It's going to open a new tab in the Safari window in the same stage, and instead it opens a new stage with a new single Safari window with the link you clicked, and it's like, what?
That's,
and the answer
good.
Is it's not ready yet. That's the answer.
I also think it makes perfect strategic sense now to separate the iPad and the iPhone, and to have, you've got an iPhone event in September, focus on the iPhone. That's good. And then you're going to have an iPad event. Why not release iPad OS? That's kind of also a measure of the bifurcation of iOS and iPad OS. It's just the continued bifurcation.
Yeah,
not even the Macification, because I still think iPad OS is very distinct from Mac OS.
Yeah, it's just drifting a little further away from the iPhone and a little bit closer to the Mac, but they're not merging them. The one thing that I understand the frustration of, there are a lot of iOS developers, and their apps run on both the iPhone and the iPad, because it is the same base OS. And my friend James Thompson, who's an iOS developer, said this the other day, that the challenge is you are releasing if you release your iOS 16 version when the iPhone ship, that's great. But the day that the iPad version ships, all your iOS 16 features light up on the iPad. You haven't tested them with the final version.
That's
if there are bugs, you're going to get negative reviews. So I think Apple, if Apple's going to keep doing this, Apple needs to maybe put in some features that allow developers to have more control of like when the iPhone version drops versus when the iPad version drops. Because up to now, it's just been assumed that it's going to be the same time. And if it's not going to be the same time,
good
then maybe
point.
They need some more developer tools there.
That's a very good point. I didn't even think about that. What are we thinking for the Apple event? I'm looking at the September calendar. September 6th, obviously, day after Labor Day, is out. September 13th, the following week, you think? Mm.
It hasn't always been out. I think that they did do one that was like a Tuesday or a Thursday after Labor Day.
Yeah, it might have been even in the Wednesday after Labor Day, right?
Oh, they could do that.
A day.
They could do that. So I guess it's impossible at this point to predict how far off. It's roughly a month off, one way or the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also in previous years, they have to schedule around September 11th. So
that's not an issue. That's a Sunday this year.
Right, exactly. Okay. So that's why it's...
That's right, yeah. The good news, according to Ming-Chi Kuo, iPhone 14 is not facing supply chain issues. Production and shipment are on track. They're building them not only in China, but they're also going to in Taiwan. They make the chips, but also in India. They're going to start production at the same time, and I think in Brazil as well. So
I think that's something we want to watch that progress. You know, the India, Brazil now. Ostensibly, that's partially because you want to do local production, but
India because and Brazil because of tariffs.
They demand it,
they demand it. But I will say that China's antics over the last little bit has, I think, everybody that's doing production in China going, oh, we need to get out of here.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan, upsetting China. China did live fire exercises right
off. They fired missiles over top of the island.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like if you're watching Ukraine and then you watch that,
it's scary.
I think that every company doing anything in China is trying to figure out how to diversify. It's probably the most expensive thing it's probably going to cost China trillions of dollars over the next decade as people start to go, we need to be not in this country, at least not always. Like, everyone's been pretty lulled into, hey, we can just do it all in Shenzhen, like, or whatever, you know, like we can just produce all these things, and they've built up all that capacity. And now how does Apple really talk its way through an invasion in Taiwan? You know, and I think that
that's necessarily the biggest concern. For instance, Pelosi met with Pegatron executives. And so the stories were that some China was blocking Pegatron shipments to Chinese plants for the iPhone assembly. Things like that are, I don't think, maybe people are worried about an invasion. But I think
politically, it gets really complicated if they actually go into Taiwan. And, you know, China only has the leverage it has right now. I know, but I'm saying, how does Apple say...
That's where all of Apple's chips are made, is at TSMC. I mean...
Yeah. Currently. You know, and so the thing is that both Taiwan and China start to become hot potatoes, and companies can't do anything about it immediately. Like, they're gonna follow the party line and do what they need to do to make it work. But that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, these things happen over decades and over years or a decade. And once they go that direction, they don't come back. It's not like everyone is now figuring out how to diversify from China, and they won't come back when they figure it out. Like, this is like China has really, I think it's an unforced error on their part over something that they should. I mean, it's crazy that they're trying to, I know it's a pride thing for them, but it's a crazy thing for them to be going after Taiwan.
There's a lot of geopolitical stuff going on. There's a party congress in October. There's thinking that Xi is worried about losing his role if he doesn't show that he's a strong man. I think it's pretty clear after the invasion of Ukraine that would be a very foolish economically to invade Taiwan. But that doesn't stop them from doing things like halting shipments that are labeled Taiwan, right?
Yeah, I mean, also TSMC had a one-on-one with Pelosi, partially to talk about what the effect of the CHIPS Act is going to be with the
which, by the
US
way, and signed yesterday, so or today, maybe, just signed. So that's good news.
That, And that came like a week or two after TSMC basically put out a policy statement saying that, look, war between China and Taiwan is not going to help China, Taiwan, or the international chip industry. And basically TSMC is saying that we side on the side of capitalism in this role. and part of the discussions that they're having is that they legitimately want to branch beyond Taiwanese manufacturing to make sure they are not necessarily under the thumb of whatever China chooses to do in the next few years.
Well, in fact, TSMC is building a massive $1 trillion plant in Arizona for this very reason, I think.
Right. Yeah. And it's also, there's also a related story about it's part of the things that makes all of this politics in China so hard to fathom is that you don't know how much of this is deeply held, politically motivated beliefs that, look, this is a line we will not cross. Do not test us on this. And how much of this is, look, we have to save face somehow. We've made all this posturing. We have to do something. So when Apple and other manufacturers get hassled by the government saying that, by the way, all of these boxes that are of shipments that are coming into China saying product of Taiwan, no, you're going to basically relabel, make sure they're all labeled that a product of China, product of whatever they
It says Taiwan, China, which the Chinese love, because that means Taiwan is part of China, which of course Taiwan disputes.
And now Apple has basically put out messages to all of their suppliers saying, look, you got to box all of our incoming stuff exactly this way. Right. That law was apparently in effect for a while, but just wasn't really enforced. So it's kind of interesting as a data point that they are choosing to enforce it right now, right when China needs to have some sign that, hey, look, we made you reprint your boxes. So, don't pull the tail of the dragon, sir.
TSMC's chip factory in Arizona is a 5-nanometer process. It will start production, according to TSMC, early 2024. So this gives you some idea. I mean, this is a long way off. There's a Japanese plant, more for legacy nodes, end of 2024. And then they have a Taiwanese plant that's coming online. The 3-nanometer plant, which probably is most interesting to Apple, is in Taiwan.
Those are the most valuable product lines. So if most of the money goes into making the most valuable processors, China will be left to basically be making chips for cars, which are really important, and chips for talking Billy Bass fish, which are not quite so important.
But very lucrative.
Very lucrative. That is a great commercial. It's good for dads or grads.
And again, I think you're going to see something that happens over a very long period of time, but it's going to be really expensive for China. Like when you look at the stack up, and it's not a great timing for them, because I mean, over the next decade, China is going to go through a population bomb, and that is going to be traumatic, for them. And so for them to undermine their ability to generate revenue in addition to all of this is complicated, really complicated.
Yep. That's a big threat too, because it seems as though every important political movement or government going back to the United States Revolution that we had a couple hundred years ago, it doesn't happen unless the people who are very, very rich are concerned that the current government is not going to help them continue to become very, very rich. That if all the people who are making money in China suddenly realize that, hey, look, we have this flag waving president that is more interested in the stature of China and his own political power than in all these factories that are making us kajillionaires, continuing to make us kajillionaires. Once he loses the support of the people who are essentially operating the economy in that country, that will make that person very, very vulnerable.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a little break. More to come. Jason did a little investigation over the iMessages kerfuffle with the Secret Service. I thought your article was kind of a response to something we talked about on the show, and you did some digging, which is good. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Jason Howell from sixcolors.com.
Not Jason Howell.
Did I call you Jason Howell? Oh, crap. Too many
double
Jasons.
L's.
How many Jasons were all born in that 5-year period?
I was always Jason S. in school. Always.
Yeah.
Except for that one time where there were two Jason S's and we had to go, there's a lot of Jasons.
We thought when we named Henry, which was such an old-fashioned name in 1994, that'd be safe. And there were like eight Henrys in his class. So it's a problem. We call some of them by their last name. Some of them we call Henry Hank now because of the confusion. So
remember how big Friday the 13th was. So a lot of parents want to name their kids Jason after that. Yeah. Good, strong, powerful Jason, take command of the situation.
Jason
figure.
Snell,
1970s. Yeah,
Jason Snell. Also, thank Jason Anatko from WGBH in Boston, and Jason Lindsay.
I'm very, very proud. I will try to uphold the honor of the title, Jason.
I'm going to swear you in later. I'm going to swear you all in later as the Jason Society.
I swear.
My toque and ceremonial sword.
It's COVID brain fog, not senility. I'm just saying that. Our show today brought to you by Nuvei, tomorrow's payment platform designed to accelerate your business. Today, if your payment provider is holding your business back because of funky old technology, Nuvei's next generation payment technology not only boosts conversions, which is important, reduces fraud, important, and increases approval rates, it also, good news, works seamlessly with your existing tech stack. You really need to take a look at Nuvei, Nuvei. You can connect to the platform with a single API integration. With Nuvei's agile platform, your business can also add new payment methods very easily. Gives you a chance to enter more markets because they have so many currencies. And you can meet evolving customer demands. Stay ahead of the curve. Listen to this. 550 alternative payment methods offered by Nuvei. 550. And that includes crypto with local payment solutions around the world in 150 currencies. And because these are local, they offer local acquiring in 46 countries and more than 200 global markets. Your customers are happy and you're happy. Customers also benefit from all the payout options, the card issuing, the banking, the fraud management services. Nuvei can handle any high-demand peak event. Their always-on approach ensures 99.999% uptime. Five nines! Plus, flexible a la carte solutions can fit your needs, whatever they are. Nuvei is the payment platform for some of the world's leading brands. When I tell you the brands, you're going to say, oh, well, we should be, why aren't we? Why? Let's find out. Wix uses Nuvei. Valve uses Nuvei. DraftKings uses Nuvei. Can you imagine the amount of traffic they get on big sports days? Nuvei can handle it. General Motors, Valentino, Crypto.com, and many more use Nuvei. With future-proof technology and a dedicated team of 24/7, 365 human, very important, human support professionals, Nuvei prepares your business for whatever comes next. Say goodbye to abandoned carts, poor approval rates, and high chargebacks with Nuvei, the platform fast-forwarding to the next generation of payments. Turn payments into powerful accelerators for your business at Nuvei.com, Nuvei.com. Nuvei is tomorrow's payment platform. Thank you, Nuvei, for your support for Mac Break Weekly. So we were talking last week about the Secret Service, about the lost messages. The Secret Service had a story, and the question was, how credible is this story? And we had some speculation, but Jason, you did the work, which is, that's why we love you, Jason. You
which
talked,
one, me?
Yeah, not Jason Lindsay. Jason Alexander at SixColors.com. Oh, no, wait a minute.
That's my middle name. You got it. You nailed it.
Is it your middle name, really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yep.
I loved you in Seinfeld. Jason
it's
Snell.
It's not his real name, by the way.
It isn't?
It's a pseudonym, yeah.
Bastard.
It's a stage name.
Damn him. iMessage and the Secret Service, you actually talked to somebody who
Tom Bridge knows. Who knows stuff, because I didn't know stuff, but yeah. Tom Bridge knows stuff, and yeah. So he helped me out, because I didn't understand this story, right? I didn't understand how
could they screw up so badly.
It's encrypted, they say, and it's like, well, wait a second, it's end-to-end encrypted, but it's not encrypted on the device. That's why your iCloud backups have it, so what is it? And it turns out that the story here is all about mobile device management, or MDM. And if we've got listeners out there who are IT managers, they know about this. But it's like, there are so many different things. There's like, they're not using iCloud backup because it's the federal government and they're afraid of that. And so then they have like a particular MDM, and the way that it's set up, if it's not being backed up to their backup solution and it's not allowed to go to iCloud and they're not backing it up to a computer, guess what? It's not being backed up. And then if you switch to a different thing and you didn't use the old backup, you will restore the phone and you'll lose the messages. And what Tom said was, bottom line is, there is a way to work around this, but you have to have... you have to have a handset next to your handset. So you basically back it up and restore it. And it's this huge process. It's much easier to get people to just sort of wipe and reinstall. And so, you know, Tom basically said, this is a plausible story, but it doesn't answer the question, right? He said, it's 100% possible that this was malicious and 100% possible that this was accidental.
And we don't
know. It really doesn't tell us anything about it because you could do this. You could know that you wanted to wipe those messages and know that you were going to do an MDM migration and know that it's January 7th and say, let's do it right now. Or you could not know and it wouldn't matter.
The issue comes down to something called FedRAMP, which I was not familiar with that acronym. But the issue is government secrecy and document retention requirements mean you can't just back up to iCloud.
Yeah,
and,
that's right. And iCloud is not approved for FedRAMP, apparently.
Yeah.
So,
although it is a HIPAA. I was surprised that it's HIPAA compliant. Mm-hmm. So you could use it for HIPAA. He works at Jump Cloud, but he said when he worked for a healthcare startup, they weren't sure if they could use iCloud to back up their health data because of HIPAA, but they later found out that they could. However, FedRAMP not supported, I guess.
No. I mean, and it's that, you know, that old saying about never assume malevolence when it could just be incompetence.
Yeah.
And it's
like,
if it's the federal government, like, that goes double. Like, again, like what Tom said, look, is it possible that somebody said we need to lose those messages? This is the way to do it. Sure. But it's just as likely, if not more so, that they just did a migration and lost all their messages, because which is against the law, by the way. It's actually not. They need to retain those messages legally. And so by making that decision to do something that's technically expedient, regardless of whether it was a conspiracy or anything, just the act of it is actually violating the Records Act. So they should have made a better decision than that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're covering anything.
Well, and as you pointed out last week, all this is new. This is a relatively new problem. And so it's completely conceivable that they hadn't really considered this or thought about it. But now that we know it's more than just the Secret Service
that has
destroyed messages. So yeah, I'm sure they won't do
it. You can only get away with that once. That's a mulligan, you know, like it's like a, you know, we can only use that excuse one time. And I think that, I mean, there's so many things. I've worked, you know, adjacent to the government for a long time. And there are so many things in the government that you're like, wow, that's way more advanced than I expected. And so many things that you go, that's really not
They're
what
still
I
using
expected.
Commodore, you know, like 128s. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's like, you know, so it goes both ways. And I think that when you see one of those things, it's far more likely that there's no, it's far more likely there was no conspiracy. It was just a mistake. You know, I'm not saying maybe it was, but, and they got away with it once, but they won't get away with it twice.
FedRAMP is Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program.
Right.
So there. and it has to be FedRAMP compliant. I think it's probably safe to say that iCloud is not, as are most clouds, not FedRAMP.
Well, I wouldn't, if I were the federal government, I don't think I would want a system of backup that included unencrypted text messages, right? That were on Apple's servers, unencrypted. That's not great.
Especially for the Secret Service. Like, that's not...
Yeah.
It's not going to be okay.
Speaking of the cloud, get ready. You might be getting a check. We don't know how big it'll be. iCloud...
$2.13.
There was an iCloud class action lawsuit. It's been settled out of court. The class said Apple breached service terms and conditions by storing user data on non-Apple servers. I mean, we've reported many times Apple used AWS and other and Microsoft Azure. But apparently that was a breach of contract. Apple has settled out of court. The settlement includes anyone who paid for a subscription to iCloud anytime from September 16th, 2015 to January 31st, 2016.
I'm definitely getting a check.
The total amount for the class is $14.8 million, but of course...
And And you get a mocha, and you get a mocha, and you get a mocha.
Well, did you see that Tim Hortons is settling its privacy lawsuit because the app was following people around and revealing their with a free beverage and baked good?
There you go. So, which is probably more. I bet you that's higher than the cash value would have been for every person.
So the lawyers take their cut. The balance is distributed between everybody in this class, which is probably millions of people, right?
I make fun of this. To be fair, the reason that these lawsuits happen is to keep companies in line.
Yes,
you know that it hurts, and that they should do it. And the lawyers are going to walk away with 40% of that amount. That's typically what they might get cut down to 25, but somewhere between 25 and 40% is going to go to the firm. The point is that it's a slap on the wrist. It's not really to do anything for anybody else. It's just to make sure that the reason we want that to happen in our legal system is that the law probably affects us as consumers far more than federal law. You know, the risk of the risk of being sued has a much bigger impact on companies' behavior than the risk of a federal law.
And sometimes it's being sued by a really important federal agency.
Ecosystem.
The SEC can't arrest you, but the SEC can file civil lawsuits. So coming up. We'll talk about that tomorrow with crypto, because there's really a question now if cryptocurrencies are securities. And if they are, big time problems with the SEC.
Also, this ruling is also commensurate with the amount of actual damage that people suffered based on this. This is basically comes down to Apple said they were going to do this. They didn't do that. What is that breach of trust worth? And so if it's worth a latte and a baked good, that's okay in this instance, because it is a public disgrace. It also makes it harder for Apple on the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth violation of this in the coming 5 years to say that, oh yes, we do take this problem very, very seriously. The fact that we keep selling these lawsuits basically every 9 to 11 months doesn't mean we don't take it seriously and we're just using this as a checkbook way of getting out of our promises. And that's when the government does step in and say, yeah, we're going to have make you feel some pain here.
If you're one of those people, which I think we all are, you don't have to do anything. You will receive a check to the address that you were registered with iCloud with at the time. If you want to know more or change the payment method or opt out, you can opt out. StorageClassActionSettlement.com.
I'm not taking your blood money. I want a personal apology. Yes, a personal apology, Tim. I thought we were friends.
Oh, too late. You can't submit a claim. It's over. It's done. So you can't change your payment method. I apologize. You're in the class, and you will get a check sometime in the next, I don't know, few months.
You wonder why you didn't get invited to my Oscars party. Well, there you go. It
says, please do not telephone the court to inquire about this settlement. Okay, thank you. Don't call them. Don't call us. We'll send you a latte and a baked good. It's on its way. That would be funny if you got got that in a box.
It has to be. But Tim's on the campus kitchen just baking. Another packet of cookies.
By the way, Apple admitted no wrongdoing. They just said,
as usual,
here's some money. Yeah. Right. Getting ready for very little talk in about AR and AR glasses. I mean, that's still the rumor. Not this year, I would guess, but next year perhaps. From the Elec, which is a good source for supply chain stuff, Samsung Display and LG Display both developing something called OLED on silicon, or OLED OS, and LED on silicon, LED OS. And the thinking is that Apple is going to do a deal or has done a deal with LG Display for OLED OS or OLED DOS. I don't know how you pronounce that. And LED DOS as well.
The pixels per inch are kind of insane.
6,000 to 7,000 pixels per inch. Yeah. Holy cow.
That would only be useful if you're putting it right in front of your eyes. So that would be. Yeah. Now, I will say I saw the 10,000 nits and I'm like, I hope they don't actually plan to give people 10,000 nits and right in front of their eyes, because that would
Highlight. Yeah.
With a 2000 nit, monitor, we get warnings that say, don't do this for too long.
Yeah. No, the 10,000 nits goes with the Samsung OLED DOS, which is only 3000 pixels per inch. So the thinking is those will be on the front. Remember, there's extra screens for some reason. Maybe on the front-facing screens, those will be the Samsungs, and the inward-facing is the one you're looking at will be the higher res, but one hopes lower nit.
It'll basically take an M1 to run that screen. I mean, that's a lot of pixels.
That's a lot of pixels.
But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to sift through with this stuff here, because it's doing stuff like what Oculus/Meta is doing. That's kind of easy because they're selling a headset that is going to be operated indoors recreationally for a few hours at a time. If they're trying to make something that could be operated anywhere, like outside during a day like this where it's super sunny, and if they're trying to make something that where people might even conceivably say, look, I'm going to be on the show floor, I'm going to be out doing this for the next 6 or 7 hours, or I'm going to be on the assembly line, I'm going to be actually on the factory floor for all day long, you need something that can be as close to human sight as possible. And that is where you get the rumors of a $3,000 introductory headset, because you can't cheap out on any of that stuff.
Yeah. Kim Kardashian... Go ahead.
Sorry. Just quickly, isn't it something like 370 frames per second or something that experimentally researchers say that if you want to approximate human vision and you want something to look like it's real, if you want a screen to look like you're looking out a window, the brain starts to get tricked in the high 300s of frames per second. And underneath that, it can detect that there's something else.
That's really high. I don't think no high frame rate movies are shot at that.
Not yet.
Can video do that?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, most of us are like at 92 to 96 frames a second, it becomes a real thing. You know, like we just think of it as a window. The 120 frames per second is something that's really popular in games, and there's a lot of testing in sports. So like literally at the Olympics, there was a huge press to go to 8K, 120 frames per second for the Olympics in Japan. That didn't happen, or it didn't happen very widely, but the test still happened. And so a lot of people are looking at it. It's not great for film. It actually makes you disoriented, you know, helicopter shots, because your brain is no longer processing it as video. It's a disorienting experience to be at over 95 frames a second or so. And it makes you sick, seasick. And, you know, when your inner ear and your eyes disagree, you think you've been poisoned, and that's what happens after that. So the high frame rate, though, is coming. I mean, everybody, all these cameras are getting set up for 120. All the TVs are already 120. The Apple TV is capable of 120. 120 is on its way. It's just a matter of where does it fit in. For film, probably not. Probably stay at 24. For lots of other things, concerts, live experiences, reality TV, you know, if they can stop using handheld, like, you know, like those are all things that are in games.
That's interesting.
And games are really big 120.
You don't want to do handheld at high frame rate.
Ooh, no.
That's bad.
No, you don't. You do not want to do that. I've done it, and it's not fun.
What happens? You just say,
you get sick.
I'm getting sick.
You get sick because it's at a high frame rate. Now, it depends on whether, as long as you can see the edges of the screen, your mind will be okay with it. But if you get it into a full frame, so if you're on a really big screen.
Or an AR.
Or you're close enough to it, or an AR, big camera moves, handheld, steady cam will make you marginally.
Makes me sick just thinking about it.
We were doing VR with the steady cam, and my brother was a steady cam operator. And he has a tendency, he gets to the end of it and he just turns 90 degrees.
Yeah.
And we left that in so that you could always tell when someone got to the end of the test because they pull their headset off really fast. It was like, they turned their whole body and it was a funny, probably not a good joke, but anyway, it was a good joke for us. So anyway, those Lindsay boys,
I tell you.
The 120, the high frame rate is going to make a huge difference for AR and VR. And again, I don't think that we're going to see it in film. You know, I think that you're going to see it in games and the experiences and so on and so forth. I think over time, when you watch a lot of high frame rate, film does look very, what we call framey. You know, like, it's just like a lot of, not very many frames there. And you notice it more because you're seeing it all the time in something else. But I think that film, it's important for film to stay at 24 because it keeps on telling your brain that it's not real.
That was an interesting tidbit in that documentary you recommended, which is so good and everybody should watch on Disney Plus, Light and Magic, about industrial light and magic. They're talking about digital cameras. I mean, this started with film, right? They're doing Star Wars.
I have that camera.
And yes, the Sony, what is it, EX?
F900.
Yeah.
F9. Well, it was a 700 when they showed up at Lucasfilm, but it became the 950.
But at one point,
F950 is the one.
George is saying, well, can it shoot 24 frames? Like, yeah. They're saying, oh, it's too many frames. We want, because they got to match, right? They got to match the film.
Well, it was because that's how all films are shot. Back then, yeah. Especially, it was like, well, we're going to do film at 24. And right. So, the camera that they brought, I believe, was like 5994i.
Yeah.
Like, it was I. And it was like interlocked.
Yeah.
It was a TV camera. And Sony had to do this really funky thing called PSF to figure out how to get from they didn't really change the camera. They just changed the way it output. They created a specific mode to take the fields and put them back together into progressive. And then you'd output it. But so my 950 still does that. But anyway, but it's a very unique thing. And then over time, of course, we went to progressive, but it was, but there was nothing that was digital that was 24 until they asked Sony to do that. And then Panasonic came out with a consumer, quote unquote, consumer version of that with the DVX-100A, I think. And then that was the first time we saw 24 in something you could buy for less than $5,000. And then, you know, then Red and, you know, all those things.
I loved it. So they're getting ready to do Star Wars and they want to do these motion cameras where they have models, but instead of having the models move, they want the cameras to move. And one of the reasons they could do this is because there was a lot of old VistaVision gear that they practically gave them because nobody's shooting in VistaVision anymore. Yeah. So they were able to use VistaVision lenses and then they hacked these cameras so that they went upside down. So there's nothing on top so they could get very close to the models. By the way, we talked a lot about this pre-show. And so if you're in the club Twit, watch for that on the Twit Plus feed. But last week, Alex recommended this Disney Plus documentary about Industrial Light and Magic, where Alex worked. And I just was blown away. It was so good. And what was really fascinating to me was this transition from Star Wars episode 4, the first Star Wars, where they're doing everything with models and stop motion, you know, with what they call practicals, physical stuff. And then this transition by 1992 and Jurassic Park, and then, of course, episode 1 and so forth, to digital. And it was like a cliff. It went boom.
And to show you, like, I don't think that they talk about this in the film, but if you want to see the very first digital scene, it's in episode 1 when Qui-Gon is sitting outside doing the Mandalorian or doing the Midichlorian count thing where he takes the thing from Anakin or whatever. That was actually shot on the Sony. That was the only shot in that movie that was shot digitally. Episode 2 was all digital, right? But episode one, that was the transition.
It's like flip.
And it looks horrible. There was no data because it was 8-bit. Yeah. It was it was at night. It was, so if you look at it, it's very like the blacks are all crushed and it didn't really turn out. But that was the very first digital.
After watching the documentary, I'm going back and rewatching all this stuff, including Jurassic Park, which was the first. Those dinosaurs they had Stan Winston building a giant T-Rex. They had Phil Tippett, who was the amazing stop motion guy, you know, doing little stop motion tests of velociraptors running. And then all of a sudden, and you talked about this before the show, two animators,
Spaz
and DePay from ILM.
Mark DePay. Yeah.
Mark DePay had been working at night after hours to put it all on the computer. And they show Steven Spielberg and Kathleen Kennedy and George Lucas. They say, well, let's show you what we've done. And at that point, everybody's jaws drop and they say, this movie can be made digitally. And it was. That's the trend. 1992. Boom. Just a clip.
And you still feel bad for Phil. Look, he's
I know.
All that work into
well,
it.
He
looks a little crushed. Like,
so
in
they
the
interview
show, like,
him. Lawrence Kasdan, who does this, interviews him. And it's a moment where, like, I guess I'm out of work. I've been doing this. I'm the best at it. I've won Academy Awards for it, and nobody's going to use stop motion ever again. But there is a happy ending, and I won't tell you. You have to watch the wonderful documentary, Light and Magic, about the beginnings of Industrial Light and Magic. Just incredible.
By the way, I'm going to plug something I worked on.
Please do.
Real quick. There is a 50th anniversary. 50th anniversary for Empire. If you really like the series, hidden on YouTube, I think on the ILM site, is a 50th anniversary discussion between Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett and Joe Jackson. You know, like all those guys are all talking about just Empire, of what it took to do Empire. And I would highly recommend just doing a search on YouTube. It's up there. It's hidden up there. I think this is it.
ILM presents Empire at 40.
At 50.
Are you sure? Because this looks like streamed live May 20th, 2020.
Oh, no. Yep. That's it.
Dennis Muren, Joe Johnston, Phil Tippett.
40. Yeah. It's a really fun discussion.
This is an amazing shot. This is stop motion, believe it or not. There's Phil Tippett animating the Tauntaun running across the snow planet of Hoth. That's how good stop motion. This is the peak of, you know, stop motion.
Right, but if you watch the Light and Magic, and you just can't get enough, this is not the same budget as the as the Kasdan one.
Another great one.
It's still a great discussion. Those guys are just brilliant.
It gave me such an appreciation for the artistry and the talent and also the devotion to the project. And yet, it sounds like it's the most fun they ever had in their lives. Like they all look back on it with great nostalgia. Like those were.
I think almost everybody looks back on Star Wars as great. I mean, because most of us, when we had the re-releases, when the re-releases came out in 1999, you know, they let all the ILM folks go to, you know, Smith Ranch Road and Roland Plaza and stuff like that. You know, like we went to see it that morning, right? The morning that they released it, or maybe the Saturday before, you know, you get to go. We used to go to a lot of movies that way. And anyway, when we saw Star Wars, when the thing came up, when the credits ended, you could hear everybody sniffling because we were all there working on Star Wars because we saw Star Wars. We were like, oh, because it came to me and I felt myself sniffling, and then I looked around at
everybody is.
It was just like, oh my gosh, we're here.
One of the most beautiful like things that ever occurred to me related to Star Wars was the idea of, like, just as you say, all these people who are working at ILM who went into this field of special effects and all kinds of other nerdy things because of Star Wars. And then suddenly, like, they're doing whatever they're doing and someone pokes their head and, hey, do you want to be in Episode 4, the special edition? We need people to fill out a background scene in Tatooine. And suddenly you are in A New Hope, which is not something that you considered even possible on any sort of, that is such a beautiful like thought to me. You know,
yeah.
Of course, I'm talking to Rumsleg, so you know.
Yeah, that's what happened to Alex.
That has to be me a couple times. Yeah. So I'm and definitely when someone walks in and says, "Hey, can you get up and do something?" You get up and, you know, whatever you're working on,
anything you'll get back you want.
But you know, I think that, you know, in addition to it, and I think you see this when you watch that documentary, is that for most of us, we were maybe not the smartest person in the room, but we were doing pretty well most of our lives. And then you get to ILM and you're just average. Unless you're just trying to keep up with everybody, because everybody it's just the most brilliant collection of people, you know, that I'd ever worked with. You know, it was just an amazing, amazing group. Yeah.
I hope that some of this comes up in your AMA. Alex is going to be doing an Ask Me Anything for our club.
I'm looking forward to it.
9 days from today, Thursday, August 18th, 9 a.m. And Ask Me Anything. If you're there live, you can ask the questions. If you're not and you're our club member, of course, that'll appear on the Twit Plus feed. I should put in a plug, because thanks to Ant Pruitt, the club is just getting more and more fun. He's our community manager.
Absolutely.
That's among other jobs. Yeah. But originally the idea was we wanted to give Twit listeners an option to get ad-free versions of the shows, you know, without tracking. And so we did that for $7 a month. And we thought, well, we'll throw in a Discord, because that's fun. And and the Discord's turned out to be, for me, the best benefit. I just love it. Great place to hang and talk about all kinds of things. We have events in there. And then there's that Twit Plus feed I mentioned, which is a chance. So we had a great conversation before the show, a half-hour conversation about all of this, which would have, in previous years, just been lost. You know, you wouldn't be preserved. Now it's part of the club feed. So $7 a month, I think it gets you a lot of great benefits, and it really helps us as we head into difficult economic times. You know, we started it in the middle of COVID because we were trying to, you know, get through that. It helped us get through that without any additional layoffs, and now I think hard times ahead as again. So if you can scrape together 700 pennies a month, we sure appreciate it. twit.tv/club. Intuit. Matthew Redcon says, "You're not. It's not going to start at 7 a.m. like office hours. No, we're going to let you sleep in."
Oh, no, literally, I will be coming right out of office.
Exactly.
Hours. I have 2 hours of office hours.
Yeah,
and then I'll just punch right into that. Yeah.
From the sublime to the ridiculous. I started this story. You might have heard me about 10 minutes ago say Kim Kardashian and wonder why. Well, Kim Kardashian's pairing with Beats to make some more muted colors for your Beats headphones. I don't want to call these flesh tones, but I think they kind of are. Beats X Kim, the collection. Zune Brown. No. This is not to look like a Zune. This is, I think, to kind of be a more neutral palette to blend in your ear.
Right. Variation of skin tones, which is a very, very nice idea.
Yeah. Although nobody's that white. Maybe they are. I don't know.
Well, speak yourself. Yeah, on top of everything else, I'm wearing headphones, so my ears aren't getting any tan either.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, you know, now that I look at you, yeah, maybe those would be the right ones.
Hey, there you go.
That's your shade. Oh, man.
Put the picture next to this, and Yeah, I think that we're...
Eastern European white, we call that.
Again, I'm optimized for winter warfare in Eastern Europe or Western Russia. This is a commodity.
The new Beats Fit Pro headphones will come in 3 earthy, muted tones, moon, that's you, Andy, dune, and earth. And the
You're right, it should have been Zune. That would have been right. Moon, dune, and Zune.
Why didn't they do it Zune?
You're a marketing genius.
Yeah, because it is Zune Brown. I hate to say it. Kim Kardashian will be featured in the ads. So more money for the Kardashian clan. That's all I can say.
Yeah. I mean, did we really need like someone? I understand the marketing power. I understand the incredible power of the brand. I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying that you could have come up with those colors on your own. You could have come up with, especially the idea of, hey, if people want to be able to wear earbuds that don't scream out, hey, look at me, I'm wearing earbuds, why don't we create them just like Band-Aids and a degree of flesh tones to approximate like a different wider range. You didn't need a Kardashian in order to make that happen, I think.
And of course, our esteemed chat room has come up with alternative marketing names for those colors. Booger Brown. Baby Puke Brown, Baby Couldn't Help It Brown. So I don't think those are going to... I don't think those... Thank you, chat room. But speaking of brands, Issey Miyake. Boy, let me get that right. You know the name. Fashion designer, passed away at the age of 84 this week. Born in Hiroshima in 1938. He lived to the age of 84. Why is this an Apple story? Because Steve Jobs asked him to design black turtlenecks in the early 80s. Miyake gave Steve 100 turtlenecks he adopted and used in his public life as the head of Apple. The garment became iconic, not only a signature look for Steve Jobs, but Elizabeth Holmes took to wearing black turtlenecks. But it's the Miyakes. The Issey Miyakes that are the most famous. And do you think Steve only had 100 and like that was the total? Or he probably got more later? I don't know.
You think they got shipped to him on a roll? He would just like tear off a new one every day?
That's a great idea. I want to roll the turtlenecks.
It's a different story. Yeah. I mean, the rumor that I had always heard was that he had to turn a factory back on and he ended up with thousands of them to get the ones he wanted. But
Apple Insider.
That could be lore.
Could be lore.
Yeah, I'd heard that he really liked it and then he couldn't. They'd already finished making them and he said, well, what does it cost to turn the factory back on?
That sounds more
accurate. 1,000 or 10,000 or something. And he just ordered them all and
that's
never wore the same one twice.
Where you find something you love and you only bought one or two of them and then they don't make them anymore and there's nothing you can do.
Oh,
if you are a billionaire. Yeah. What you do is you just, like I found, okay, I'll just say this. I found this plastic glass that I really like, plastic cup that I got at a football game. And I love it because it doesn't shatter and it doesn't bend and it's really nice. And I found the company that makes it. And I said, I want to buy some of these. And they said, minimum order 500. And I was like, I'm not going to buy 500 cups. But if I had Steve Jobs money, I'd buy 500. Sure.
I know people who
would
buy a lot of something to get it.
Yeah, I mean, right? If you really want it, and if the money doesn't matter, Like, yeah. I love that, whatever it is. Also, keep in mind, the whole idea here is that Steve Jobs didn't want to waste any brain power on deciding what he was going to wear that day. So he just got a rack of the same thing, and he wore the same thing every day.
Also, I'm sorry for interrupting. Also, one of the things that came out of the Isaacson's biography was where that connection came from, where he toured, Steve Jobs toured the Sony factory, and Sony's employees were wearing like uniforms that had been created by Issei. And so he came back saying, "Oh my God, this is great. We should have uniforms for Apple people." And to Steve Jobs' credit, he says in the interview that, "Oh boy, did I get booed off the stage for that one." But that, but the connection did stick. But that is interesting that if you want to have company uniforms for Sony, this person had to create something that was going to be practical, functional, and that people would be kind of relieved to put on every single day instead of having to solve that problem every single day.
Yeah, but a uniform, no, not so good in Silicon Valley.
You're one step away from people asking, demanding that you do push-ups like in unison every morning. Yeah. That's no.
I was going to say, no, it feels like one of those old Star Trek episodes where they beam down and everybody's wearing a green jumpsuit, and you're like, "This doesn't seem right."
This doesn't seem like a progressive.
I wandered around a lot of campuses, and they don't have a uniform, but many campuses have a look.
There is a look for sure.
There's a look.
Yeah, there is a look.
So it's, but they achieve it organically. That's the important
thing. Yeah, exactly.
Isaacson continues in the Jobs biography. He asked Miyake to supply him with a large number of black turtleneck sweaters on sale from Issei Miyake Incorporated at the time for $175. "He made me like 100 of them," Jobs told Isaacson, adding, "I have enough to last for the rest of my life." There you go. There is actually a precedent for this story that maybe he restarted the factory because the folks who made Gorilla Glass, Corning, had already shut down the Gorilla Glass factory. They weren't going to make any more when Apple came to them and said, "We would like it for our new iPhone. And here's money to restart the glass factory." And ever since, I think they've been subsidizing Corning and Gorilla Glass because they like it for the iPhone. So it's not unbelievable, let's put it that way.
People, that's a long history. I mean, the Boston Public Library, the architect wanted this special kind of marble that had stopped being quarried for 20 years. The quarry was closed. Everyone had moved out. He got them to reopen the quarry to get them just enough marble for this one little hallway.
Wow.
So yeah, money and creative craziness talks always.
Yeah. Speaking of broken iPhone screens, OtterBox now will pay part of the way at least for a broken iPhone screen if you buy an OtterBox screen protector, Amplify or Alpha. You then get, there's an OtterBox protection program. So you're really still buying insurance because these are not inexpensive screen protectors, but you can get reimbursement up to 12 months after purchase. I do not like to, they're $40 to $55 screen protectors. I do not like to put on screen protectors on any of my stuff. If you put a glass screen protector on, does it prevent your screen from breaking?
Oh yeah,
it does.
I have a case and a screen protector. I mean, this thing is my phone is still in mint condition. I mean, I spent $2,000 on this phone. I'm going to put it in something. Like I'm just like, you know, like I have a, this is a decked out, you know, whatever, 13 Pro, and it costs a lot of money. Right. I'm not going to crack it. You know, like, you know, and I'm definitely, and I have to admit, I had my last phone, I had a screen protector on it. It got some air under it. So I just took it off, scratch the heck out of it in like a week. because I'm so lazy about what goes up against that screen. And I just suddenly was realizing there's all these scratches that I didn't have before because it was in pristine quality for almost a year and then not. And so I absolutely put screen protectors on. It's not a big deal. The new application, putting them on is nothing. I don't think it affects the quality of the audio of it. And
you can't tell there's a screen protector on it.
No, I can't. Of course, I've had screen protectors on it for so long, but I don't notice it at all.
You don't notice.
No, I don't notice. The performance is exactly the same as far as I'm concerned. It works great. And one of my favorites is the one I put on my iPad, the one that's a paper. Like on my older iPad Pro, I put the paper one on. I just love doing storyboards.
That's kind of cool. Yeah, that feeling.
That friction.
Yeah.
Oh, I just love it. Yeah. I just love using that just to do storyboards. Because
what's the brand of that? What's the name of that again?
Oh, I'd have to look.
Here, it was a pick.
Bought it on YouTube. You know, I mean, I'm not on YouTube. I bought Amazon. It on Amazon.
I confuse them. They're very similar.
But it's easy for me to find usually.
Yeah, that's what I do. Looking. I constantly go through my Amazon orders to find something. When people say, "Well, what did you buy?" I'm very curious because I think maybe I should do this for my iPad Pro. New iPad Pros.
Paper feel.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what I got. That's the one I used. I don't know if it's any. Sure. It's probably one Japanese.
Paper like.
One Japanese Chinese company.
Paper like
was another one.
Paper like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably all made in the same factory.
Yeah.
Probably.
But it is kind of interesting how dogmatic Apple is about, our phones are so durable and they're so beautiful. Yeah. You would never want to put them in a case. They came out with a new Switch to iPhone, really good Switch to iPhone video a couple of weeks ago for people who are, if you're switching to Android, it's like simple, punchy, 4.5 minutes. Here are the top 6 questions that people might have and here are answers to them. And when they get to the section of, hey, can I carry over all my data from an Android? Oh yes, here's how easy it is. She's got in one hand, she's got like a iPhone 13, no case. In the other hand, she has a Pixel 4a, absolutely in a case. And I don't think that's an accident. I have the Pixel 4, it's the 4a 5G, but I have the 4a. It's not like there's a big Google logo on the back of it. It's not as though there's anything on the back of it that identifies it as it's not like there's a big Samsung logo on the back of it. So it's like, okay, you're definitely making the case that this phone looks uglier. So we are definitely putting a phone in a case for the Android side.
This one is a little concerning. We've talked before about Unreal Engine not being available for Apple Silicon. Developers who want a game engine pretty much are using Unity. Unity may be in play now. AppLovin, of all people, has offered to buy Unity for $17.5 billion, no cash, all stock.
That's a horrible deal for Unity.
It's an 18% premium on their Monday closing price,
sure,
but who wants to be owned by AppLovin, and who knows what AppLovin stock will be? The board has to approve it. This could end up being a hostile takeover if the board does not approve it. And here's the other bad deal. Unity investors would hold more than half the shares of the combined company, but AppLovin would have more than half the voting power.
That's a horrible, that would be a horrible deal for the shareholders. I can see, the problem is Unity bought some stuff that puts them in direct competition with AppLovin. So this is, I think, more of a defensive move by AppLovin to try to get a hold of Unity because that Unity may crush them. That's the problem. This is their high point. I don't even know how they get the valuation to that point, to be honest with you. It's probably something with KKR that they're trying to organize. But I don't think this one doesn't pencil out at all. I think
the risk
that would be
is
a horrible idea.
It might put Unity in play, which others might then come in and say, "Well, wait." And I don't
possibly.
Yeah, this is all. It just makes for instability. We've seen it with Twitter. It just makes for instability. It's not a. Yeah. It's not a good thing. And Unity is it pretty much the only way at this point to do a multi-platform game on Apple?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It definitely runs better on the Mac than Unreal. I mean, even on the Intel Mac, Unreal is pretty clunky on the to run it. So you really need a PC to use Unreal, in my opinion. They're better at different things. So they're not, I used to think that Unreal, for a long time, we forgot that Unity existed. Like it was just all Unreal,
right.
Unreal. And then the lawsuit happened and all of us are just, whoa, we don't now don't know. And then Unity also bought the Weta Digital. So they have an incredible amount of content. R&D and technology that they acquired there. So there's been a bunch of moves here, which is really good for the consumer, that there's two companies that are doing, they're not apples to apples. They do different things well. A lot of us have felt like Unity is a little bit better on the AR stuff than Unreal is. But Unreal is really powerful with MetaHuman, with a lot of the assets, with the marketplace. I mean, they're still, I think, the clear leader in kind of the development of that 3D future. But Unity is a it's still very powerful, and it really is the Mac solution right now. And so hopefully, again, someone could buy them and then they keep doing what they're doing. I hope it's not AppLovin because it seems like, I couldn't, I think that it was a bold thing to say by Haploving, but I don't think that anybody in their right mind would actually allow that on the Unity side. Stockholders, investors, there is nothing good about this deal. And so I think that it's a bold...
It's such a mismatch of businesses, too. I mean, Haploving is about marketing. It's not, right?
Yeah, but I think they're worried because of some of the stuff that Unity bought, and they're trying to... I think it's more of a defensive move that they have to try to see if they can do that, because I think Unity might run them over at some point. Right. And so I think that that's really more of a defensive move from Haploving, but I think it's a horrible deal. Like, it would be disastrous for everyone connected to Unity for Haploving to do that on an all stock deal. Like, why would you,
right.
You can really believe in the company to take an all stock deal. That's a horrible idea.
Right. Yeah. One more piece that I didn't mention from iOS 16 beta 5, which was released yesterday, there's a new Find My sound. So I don't know about you. I live by Find My. I misplace my phone and my watch all the time.
Oh my
so
gosh.
Let me see. Let me see what the sound's going to sound like now. You got my sound up? All right, John. Oh, that's better. That's better. It's got. I'll give it a 9 out of 10. I can dance to it.
I just wanted to yell. I'm over here. I just want to go, I'm over here.
Right now, it's almost a high-pitched scream,
help me.
Right?
Yeah, that's awesome.
No, yeah. I really, this is another one of those cases where I really wish Apple were one of those companies that puts the engineers like in front of a camera and explaining how hard this was to do.
Yeah.
Because crafting a sound that, it has to be attention getting, but not harsh. And it has to penetrate through like layers
right.
of fabric.
Yes.
You know, it has to be able to penetrate
cushions.
Through a
yes.
door. Exactly.
Yes.
And be long enough for you to be able to sort of locate it while it's playing, right?
It's not long enough right now. I can tell you that right now. Yeah.
It's not.
And that's the difference. We can. The human brain is really good at there are high frequencies and low frequencies. Low frequencies mean that they travel much, much longer distances, but they're harder to locate. High frequencies travel short distances, but our ears can locate them very, very easily.
Yeah.
So this is part of the math that has to go into this. And this is why I really want to see the paper based on this.
The current sound is not quite so syncopated. It's just a high pitched yeah. DDD.
Faster attack on the new one. It's bing, 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 bing.
Yeah, like dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Oh, you got it, Jason. You already have it. Look at that tiny phone. Do you have massive
no
hands?
Case either? No case.
No case.
No screen protector.
No screen. Just like bare naked phone.
That's
and,
right.
And the bare naked phone
it.
Playing the new theme from I Lost
I think it's just,
It.
If they really wanted to cut through everything, they just need a baby crying. You know, that cuts through everything. Like you never miss that one.
Yeah, but again, so. we're trying to not freak people out here. That's the balance.
Retcon says it should be playing Axl Rose's Paradise City. That would be something I'd want to find and stop real quick.
No. Sweet child of mine.
Sweet child.
All
actually,
right. That would be good because it ramps up and down different frequencies of sound. So that actually would probably be very, very good.
Just the rights.
Andy.
The rights would be expensive.
Yeah.
But outside of that, we're good. Yeah. Apple's got
them. It's Apple. They'll pass along the expense of the consumer. Come on. That's never been a problem before.
Let's get ready for our picks of the week. You guys are so much fun. But we do have another show to go to in just a little bit. Let's kick the picks of the week off with Jason Snell. Your pick, sir.
All right. My pick is going to be a little weird, but because I've been here long enough now that I realize they can't always be useful. Sometimes they got to be weird. And this is a company called Firestar Toys.
You.
And you're saying to yourself, why would you choose Firestar Toys, an Etsy shop? And the answer, friends, is they have a wide collection. Do you like Lego? Do you like Lego minifig? Are you sad that things aren't licensed that you love, but aren't licensed for Lego minifig? And the answer is, would you like to get, for example, Hawaiian Detective?
Ooh.
Who is actually
strangely,
Magnum P.I.?
Strangely mustachioed.
Right at the edge. Beautiful.
Of Magnum P.I., but he's available on their site as Private Detective.
Yeah.
They have basically taken a bunch of pop culture figures.
Kind of like
this store makes
fried chicken mogul.
makes custom Lego minifigs that resemble things you know and love from pop culture. So in honor of Magnum P.I., Roger Mosley, who was on that show, just passed away. I'm going to just say, I have a Magnum P.I. minifig. And there's also a Ferrari, by the way. So there's an official Lego Ferrari, so you can put him in the Ferrari if you want to.
Has that been recalled as well? Probably, yeah.
You name it. There he is. There's the private eye.
I love it.
But anyway, there's lots of different choices you have there if you want to get your Lego
I like,
on.
I like the chest hair. That's hysterical.
Oh, man. It's so there's, good. There's Hawaiian detail. Shirt, chest hair, gun, mustache, the hair, the whole thing. And these are Lego minifig parts. Some of them are custom printed. Some of them are not.
This is awesome.
And they source them and put them together. So if you've got a Lego set or something like that, it is a Lego minifig. It will work in that space. So you can put
there
in a Ferrari
dozens of them
in a TIE fighter or wherever, and yeah, you name it, they got it. It's amazing.
Mentally unbalanced journalist, I've got to own this one.
Yeah, the names are also beautiful, right? Because they yeah, can't legally like, use the name. So, like, if you want to,
basically,
Bob Ross,
they took the Magnum PI body and put a briefcase in his hand and a crazy head on.
And then he's Hunter S. Thompson, isn't
and
that
Hunter
great?
Hunter S. Thompson, yeah.
Happy little painter who is literally the Bob Ross minifig. It just goes on and on. It's amazing.
So great. Oh,
so that's my pick.
God, great!
It's the
pick.
Five Star Tories awesome. Etsy shop. They're very nice. My Magnum PI got lost in the mail, and I sent them a note saying I never got it, and they sent me another one right away. Very
How
good.
How do you think they make these?
I think they've got a library of actual Lego pieces, and then I think they do some custom printing on generic Lego pieces with the custom designs.
These
that's
are
my guess.
So cool.
Yeah, they're really good.
Wow.
And they don't feel fake. They feel real. So they don't feel like it's like a 3D printed part or something.
Yeah.
It feels like the real deal.
Yeah. Oh, this is fantastic. Etsy.com/Firestart Toys.
Firestar Toys.
Star Toys. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or it could be Firestart Oys.
Start Oys?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Anyway, if you're a fan of Doctor Who, I'm just saying Time Traveling Captain is available.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Andy, your pick of the week.
My pick is kind of specific for people in Boston. I know Boston Comic Con / Fan Expo Boston is this weekend, but that costs you money to get into, but it's a good time. It's especially good for those of us who used to go to Mac World Expo Boston, because it takes place in the exact same part of Boston. So it's very, very weird to be sweltering in August, overdressed for an occasion, and heading down to the waterfront. It's a trip, man. But the real pick of the week is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in Boston Common. Boston Common puts a big, big performance stage up for the month of August, and there are some really good performances happening Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Boston Lyric Opera is putting on a full production of Romeo and Juliet, the classic opera. These performances are free from 8 p.m. It'll probably go for another like 2 hours after that. That's happening on Thursday and on Saturday. On Friday, there is a part of the Tito Puente performance stage. There is a Latin music festival or Latin music performances, and it really shows off like why people from Boston who like Boston like Boston. It's like walking home from work or walking home for something, and you didn't know that there's going to be an opera on your way to Park Street Station to get to get to the subway, and you wind up being 3 hours late for work because you decided to sit and listen to Latin music for an hour and a half. So these are great stuff. It's on Tremont Street near the bandstand, the Sgt. Pepper style bandstand that you never see anybody actually performing in. It's mostly used as a landmark these days than as a performance space. But it's going to be a good time, and the weather's supposed to break a little bit. It's supposed to be only in the mid 70s. So for Boston in August, that's pretty darn good.
I know, Jason, that you like custom coding scripts and adding them to your system. And I'm wondering if you've ever heard about something called Ubersicht.
No.
This is a really cool widget program, free for your Mac, tracesof.net. And you can have you could have Bash scripts, Python scripts, any kind of scripts with their own widgets that you can then kind of embed into your Macintosh screen. So, for instance, if you use OpenHAB, you can have a widget that actually tells you what's going on with a variety of things. It creates a widget folder. These are basically HTML5, scripts. So it's very simple. You could write your own in JavaScript and React. And there are so many other people who are writing scripts. You probably don't have to write your own. You could find little scripts for weather, for world clocks, for scores, for your current Bitcoin price. all kinds of little dashboards that you just embed on your Mac. I know. Doesn't this look cool?
This is nice. This is like the return of dashboard
right.
a little bit.
But they're always there, right? They're always there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much. I haven't played with it too much to know exactly how functional it is. But, you know, like, in other words, can you interact with them and things like that? I think you can. And there's so many widgets out there that you certainly could get an idea of what you might want to do using, terminal script like Bash or Z Shell or Python or other things in addition to just HTML5. Ubersicht, UberSicht, but it's at tracesof.net.
Nice.
And it is free, and it's very easy to install, and it doesn't require any weird, you know, kernel modifications or anything like that. Finally, we go to Alex Jason Lindsay for his pick of the week. Hey, I could have called you Jason Statham. I didn't. I thought I'd make it simple.
Yeah, so we have good sessions on office hours. We do a lot of them. And then we have great sessions. And this morning was a great session. We had Dan Tepfer from Farplay, not Fair Play, but Farplay. What Farplay does is allows musicians to interact with each other. I mean, basically play together. And we had an incredible jazz, like half an hour of jazz being played by four different artists, hundreds of miles from each other, live, being able to riff together and, play back and forth and make adjustments and so on and so forth.
Huge. This is such a problem because of latency. And so many people have tried to play music together with Zoom and
very low latency. So, to give you a sense of it, because Zoom is going, to a server and then back, and it has quality and it has to work for everybody and everything else, your latency is about 225 milliseconds per leg. So that's about we consider that really good. It's probably
one of
the shortest.
It's fine. Yeah.
For conversation, it's fine. So Farplay, across the United States would be about 40 or 50 milliseconds. So about four times lower. And on the East Coast is going to be under, 20 milliseconds or less, because it's peer to peer. So basically when two people are talking, they're not going through any server. They're just going straight to each other. Right. And so that latency is super low. And
here's the clap test without Farplay, just so you can see the difference. Here they're doing it without Farplay. There's the difference.
Oh my god!
You can't play music
that
way,
sound
right?
Simultaneous.
But if you could get that closer together, you could play together or sing together.
And so they're playing complex jazz together.
Over
online. And up until recently, you could only do it with two people because it was just that's where they were with the technology. Now it is limited to your computer CPU and your bandwidth, like how many people you can go, because remember it's peer to peer with everybody. So you could have, we had four musicians on this morning, but you could keep, this is the show here. And it was, so those four musicians are, anywhere from tens to hundreds of miles apart. And, if you go into, I was talking about something else, but it's like second hour. Yeah. You just jump in. There you go.
There it is. Okay. Here they are playing. That's kind of amazing that such a thing can be done. I know so many musicians. In fact, I get calls on the radio show all the time from people who are saying, how can we solve this? How can we do this? And if you've ever heard us try to sing Happy Birthday in a Zoom call, it's very hard.
And it would work. It would work here.
Yeah.
This
is cool. This is office hours. Good Lord. You guys are having a concert.
Oh, my gosh. And I will tell you, having concert-level musicians helps. It definitely makes it a better show.
How neat. How neat. Officehours.global if you want to. That's today's show, 868, if you want to see them performing.
And it's just amazing. Like, it is, but the technology behind it, because it's written by someone who is, Dan actually works on it, and because it's written by someone who is a very accomplished musician who understands what's necessary. It has things like they can play at one latency and they might hear some dropouts, But the latency that goes out to the broadcast can be different to make sure that it fills those in. And the latency for the recording can be different. And it's delivering all those tracks to, you know, as individual tracks. So you can send it all into Reaper and record all the individual tracks.
Yeah, get it right.
And remix it later. And so there's a whole bunch of you know, tools in there that are, you know, you have an app being developed by someone who truly is using it, who truly understands all of the issues that are related to it and all the things that have to be done. And it is, and it's, oh, by the way, the most advanced version of it is about $8 a month.
Wow.
Like, you know, like, nice. Which is for those of us who do have other versions of this that do this kind of thing that aren't as low latency, but do deliver many tracks. It's a lot more expensive than $8 a month. And so this is an incredible deal. Incredible. If you're a musician that wants to riff, and again, there's a free version that you can download, and two people can do it back and forth for up to 45 minutes for free. You can just use it. So if you're teaching lessons, for instance, you know, or you just want to riff with someone for a little while, the free version is free and it will do all the things you need it to do. The standard version is like $6. The advanced version that really gives you all the bells and whistles is $8 a month. And so if you're really doing this for seriously, it's a really good deal. And again, you can get into it for free, test it, use it for up to 45 minutes. And then, of course, just close it and open it again. The only person that has to have the license is the person starting the show. So you could have one person paying $8 a month and eight people just join in and start going. So very it doesn't, fair. Not everybody has to have it.
That's nice.
And like kind of like Zoom or whatever. And so it is, wow, really exciting technology. I mean, this has been something that COVID
pushed. Farplay, FARPLAY.io. But I think the first thing you should do is go to officehours.global and watch the interview and the performance with Dan, because that's a really great way to learn more about it. And that's one of the things that makes Office Hours so exceptional. Officehours.global, if you want to join in, you can watch after the fact on YouTube, but honestly, join the Zoom conversation. And you could be a part of it. And it goes not just in the morning, but really all day. And then there's the Super Saturdays, the Sabado Gigantes. And
now we have more and more, like we have labs that are starting up every. We have like Ecamm Live. Ecamm is being a lab on Tuesday. We have web development on Wednesday. On Thursday, we have Isadora, which is this incredible app that that allows us to automate for theater and for our broadcast. Our entire infrastructure is based on it.
Nice.
And then we also today had a lab on SRT, and now we have Final Cut Labs and you know, NDI testing labs. There's lots of things that are just kind of building up around it. It just keeps
nice.
I would, yeah, growing.
Lovely. Officehours.global. Thank you, Alex. And of course, if you want to hire Alex, 090.media. Now in the beautiful, what is it, optical?
The Kerner Optical.
Kerner Optical building.
We've been there for years. We moved in when we, yeah, we moved in right in the beginning of COVID. And so we've been there for a long time.
Nice.
A lot of bandwidth, a lot of fiber.
I bet. Some reason, some prior tenant must have needed it. Yeah. Andy Iannacco, always a pleasure to have you on. When are you going to be on WGBH next?
Next Friday at the usual time, 12:50 or 10 minutes to 10 in the afternoon. Go to WGBHnews.org to check out the live stream or the saved streams, or go to WGBH's streaming channel on YouTube to watch it live or watch it later.
You can also, of course, look for Andy's logo, custom designed mentally unbalanced journalist, on online. Wherever finer Lego minifigures are sold. It doesn't look like you at all.
Actually, there's another one that's like pretty spot on.
Does it, really?
I won't point you to it, but it's like, you know what? That is
got the burns.
Also, I also got the round sort of head coming.
Podcaster.
Up.
Yeah. Yes. Great to have you. Thank you, Andy. And Jason Snell, I appreciate the time you make for us, because I know you're the busiest man in podcasting. Go to sixcolors.com/podcast for a list of them all, or just go to Six Colors. Because they're all there, along with a lot of great reporting by Jason and his colleague Dan Morin, and of course the new Downstream, which he published during this show.
During the show.
Is available.
During the pre-show. Technically during the pre-show.
Yeah, that's right. That's fair. Six Colors is the greatest. You're the greatest, Jason. Thank you for making
Thank you,
day.
Leo.
a part of ours. We appreciate it. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We do Mac Break Weekly on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. You can watch us do it live at live.twit.tv. If you're watching or listening live, you can chat live at irc.twit.tv. And, of course, Club Twit members also can chat in our Discord as they're watching the show. Many do. After the fact, on-demand versions of this show available at twit.tv/mbw. Or on YouTube, there's a YouTube dedicated YouTube channel for Mac Break Weekly. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast player, which would be very cool. That way you get it automatically the minute it's available. Oh, wait a minute. Here's a custom design. I don't know if this is Firestarter. No, this is another company. This is a custom Zelensky with Molotov cocktails. So that... that's good. I guess you could do a lot with these minifigures, right? This is from designboom.com.
Yeah. And,
wow. No limit. No limit. thank you for joining us all. We really appreciate it, and we will see you next time. But now I hate to tell you, it's time to get back to work because break time is over. Bye-bye.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.